Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here on the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, we're talking with Anna O'Connell, member of the class of 2012. After she graduated summa cum laude from PC with a degree in music education, the soprano and harpist set off for the University of Southern California, where she earned a master's degree in choral conducting. She served as director of music for the Catholic Campus Ministry at Cornell University before leaving to pursue her doctorate in historical performance practice at Case Western Reserve University. O'Connell was recently awarded the Barbara Thornton Scholarship from Early Music America. Anna, thanks for joining us and congratulations on your scholarship.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me, Liz.
So you clearly love music and specifically early music. How did this passion develop? Where did it start?
Providence College, I think. Dr. Gordon brought in her friends who play early music, and she taught me some harpsichord lessons, and I was pretty much hooked. And there was especially a class that I took but it was about singing early music, and I just fell in love with the melodies, the stories, the mythology behind it. Yeah, it was something I really cultivated at PC.
But did you come to PC with the idea that you were going to study music?
Yeah, I came as a music education major for my undergrad. And I was excited because at Providence, I could study voice and harp, which is also a thing I do. And be also in the Honor Civ program. And that was very formative too, for reading all of the mythology and history, and then a lot of early music draws upon those histories and those texts in performances. The 16th and 17th centuries, they're obsessed with Medusa and Achilles and all these characters that I read about in my civ class.
So how did you start with performance, with music performance? Did you start out as a vocalist or did you start as a harpist? Which came first?
Yeah, I think I was singing in children's choirs in my church growing up, and started taking piano lessons. My family took a trip to Ireland when I was little, maybe in sixth grade, and everywhere we went, there was pictures and sounds of harps, and Irish folk music has got a lot of harp music in it. And so a couple of years later, when I was in high school, my mom saw an ad in the newspaper, come learn harp. And so I started learning on a little therapy harp. It was a group that goes into hospitals and plays harps, but they were teaching lessons to beginners. So I started off there, and then I sort of veered off into giant concert pedal harps. Played the harp throughout high school. And then at PC, I started playing more harp, but in a kind of pop music setting. So I started playing, the open mic at McPhail's or something like that, and jamming with other friends, yeah.
So you were taking the harp through all of its, all iterations and applying it to all different musical styles. But that's not what you were playing when you were playing with the therapy group in high school? Like, you were playing mostly classical?
They were just teaching me how to play the instrument. And then I quickly switched over to like a pedal harp teacher because I was in high school, and then everybody else in the class was like little 5 or 6 year olds or something, or maybe 10 year olds. But I had played piano growing up, so that was, I already knew about music a little bit. So it was easier to go find a real, quote, real harp teacher. I mean, I really enjoyed my lessons. And I mean, with the little harps, that was great. Wasn't not real, is what I'm trying to say.
So when you were at PC, like, tell us about the music performance you did here. Like, what types of ensembles and other groups did you participate in?
I tried to just do it all. I was in the band maybe for a concert or two, playing harp. I was in a couple of orchestra things. I think I won a concerto competition, so I played a piece, a Debussy piece, with the orchestra. And then I sang in all of the choirs. I started with Oriana Women's Choir, and then got into E Cantori eventually. I sang in the chapel choir with Sherry Humestain, and yeah, and I loved giving performances in the chapel and in the little stage in the Smith Center for the Arts. Yeah,
definitely. And is that where you got your first? Is PC where you got your first taste of conducting?
Almost. I remember in high school, I was really gung-ho, and the band teacher was like, oh, let me teach you, you know, some conducting patterns. And I was like, yeah. And I directed a treble voice ensemble a cappella group. Yeah. So Tickled Pink is what it was called. Yeah, so I got to direct them my senior year of high school, and kids at my high school were a little competitive, so I felt like I really had to know what I was doing. And then I got to really deepen that understanding at PC with TJ, and he really took the time to teach me and give me lessons and pointers and tips. And I credit him a lot with helping me get into conducting. So it was kind of at Providence. I was conducting just for school and for for classes, but also for student teaching my senior year. I think I was at Ponagansett High, but I can't remember.
you were conducting high school groups.
Helping conduct a high school choir. Yeah.
So how did you decide to go on and study it in graduate school?
So I realized that I still didn't, I was about to, you know, graduate with a music education degree, but I feel like I didn't know how music really worked. I feel like there were so many parts of music that I didn't understand and I wanted to deepen my understanding of. And ultimately I thought I might want to teach collegiately rather than high school or middle school. And music ed gave me the foundation to do any of those things. And I was just feeling, maybe I wanted to learn more, you know, there's more out there to this music thing that I didn't get a chance to explore. So then I applied to a bunch of schools for conducting. And then I got accepted into the degree for choral music at University of Southern California, which TJ Harper went to, and also Troy Quinn, who was the director of the Apollo Choir, or the Oriana Women's Choir. He was then doing his DMA there. He was the conductor my freshman year at PC. And I thought, hey, that sounds like a cool thing. And the allure of Los Angeles was really interesting to me. And just, you know, trying to understand this really high level of music making and get more of that, because I didn't have enough in undergrad.
Well, it's interesting because Troy Quinn, who was a PC music student here, you know, now has gone on to be quite the conductor and got to conduct the Rhode Island Philharmonic in their summer pop series.
Yeah, that's awesome.
PC, lots of music alumni doing really well. Can we talk a little bit about how your music fits into your faith life and vice versa? Because I know a lot of the performances that you do as a soprano, you're participating in groups and conducting groups that are faith-based. So how does it all fit together?
Yeah, I think when I was trying to figure out, all right, what's next after my master's degree, I had been singing and directing a church choir at USC. I was helping out with the campus ministry there, and I was directing one of the mass choirs at USC. And I got to participate in a dedication ceremony for their new chapel at USC, which was really exciting. And I got to plan the music, and I took a deep dive into the liturgy. And I feel like, yeah, I did a project, maybe it was an independent study or something when I was at PC about the liturgical changes in the language used by the Catholic Church in 2010. And trying to figure out, well, where does that leave music? Because we have so many hymnals and so much written word, and are there major changes that are going to happen? And so since then, I've kind of been obsessed with hymnals. I have like kind of a small hymnal collection, and I think I realized somewhere along the way that our liturgy is so vast and it's so expressive, and the words and the music are, you know, it's kind of this like the bubbling of the Holy Spirit, you know, it's so effusive and there's so much music. And then at certain points in history, someone says, hey, all right, this is too much music. Let's tamp this down. Let's be a little more civilized here. You know, church has to last an hour. and so you get different versions of the liturgy through centuries and centuries. And so lately I've been really obsessed with medieval music and late medieval music right before like Palestrina and some church reformation in the 1500s or maybe 1400s, not the 1500s. And so you have this really expansive liturgy with really amazing and beautiful prayers. And I think a lot of my interest in that comes from, I guess, the language about Mary. And I felt a special devotion to Mary at PC. I remember like whenever I had a rough day, I would go into the chapel, and then there on the left, there's that like beautiful statue. And I would just kind of be like, what's going on? tell me what to do next. What should I do with my life? You know, every decision I made in undergrad was under that statue. And it's just, you know, the language is so kind of absurd and beautiful that medieval people use about her. I don't know if I have anything offhand, but it's, you know, oh, Mary, you know, cornerstone of the foundation, or, you know, under the or like the Solomon's temple, or filled with pearls and rubies of greatest value. There's all this really awesome medieval poetry that like I think needs to come back.
But that really like captured you and like,
yeah.
Tell us about the Barbara Thornton Scholarship. What will it allow you to do? What are you going to do with that?
So Sequencia is a group, an early music group that I've always listened to. Barbara Thornton was a member of that group, founding member. She passed away at a young age, I think, due to some sickness or cancer or something. This scholarship will allow me to explore medieval music, specifically in Europe, because the founding members of Sequencia were able to go and learn with people in Europe. And so they wanted to keep that kind of going. And so I'm excited to spend next summer going to different like medieval summer camp and learning with different people. There's a couple of women I want to study with that they sing medieval German music that I'm really into. So I'm excited to go meet them and sort of shadow them and maybe take some harp lessons and meet Benjamin Bagby again, who's also a member of Sequencia. And he is a really phenomenal, I think, you know, when I was studying Beowulf or something in undergrad at PC, his video of like him reciting Beowulf with the lyre was just like so cool. And like, I want to figure that out too, you know, sing these epic ballads with a little bit of harp accompaniment or something.
Yeah. You've already gotten to do quite a lot of travel in your career. Can you tell us about singing at the Vatican and at the Great Wall of China and in Hawaii and in Krakow or anywhere else? You know, if there are any other places on that list, you probably haven't added to it too much during the pandemic, but.
I had right before the pandemic, I was in Hong Kong and Taiwan performing Bach with the Hong Kong Early Music Society.
like January 2020?
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. And we were sitting to tea with my boyfriend's grandfather, and everybody's looking at the TV going, mysterious virus out of Wuhan. What does this mean? And I was like, oh, that probably won't be anything. How wrong I was. it was pretty intense.
So you've sang in Hong Kong and have returned healthy.
Yeah.
Continue.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So tell us about some of these other experiences. What brought you to the Vatican?
So Providence College, I was on tour, I think my junior year, the choir and band went on tour to Italy. And that was just an amazing trip. We went to the Vatican, we toured around, and then we also got to sing there, which was just phenomenal. And the food, it's like, you know, just tasting new things that are just so much better than you've ever experienced. There's so much art and architecture and really beautiful. I think we also went to Siena to visit the Shrine of Catherine of Siena, and just this amazing medieval architecture and cobblestone streets. And, you know, the walls are so close you can touch them in the roads and kind of winding your way through this medieval town. Like, yeah, that also.
And some other locations like the Great Wall of China. Was that part of that? That wasn't part of your Hong Kong tour?
No, that was a choir tour I went on with USC. So right after I graduated with them, I got to go to Beijing and Korea for that trip. Choir brings you many places. It's so cool. And it was just fascinating because I'd never been to Asia, and to just see there's this huge world out there, this wide world that I know so little of. To go to mass in Beijing at one of the sanctioned churches was really interesting. And you could see how faithful people are and the music that they're singing, and they have the giant projections, which I couldn't read because it was in Chinese characters. But it was really a really fascinating and strange experience. Yeah.
And in 2016, you performed at World Youth Day.
Yeah. So when I was a campus minister at Cornell University and also Ithaca College, I was a campus minister and director of music for those ministries. I had the opportunity to bring students to World Youth Day. So I brought a group of, I think, six people, and we went to Krakow, Poland, to go to World Youth Day. And then I also applied to perform there. So there was this giant stage, and I got to sing some Gregorian chant and some other kind of folk music or pop music that had religious themes. And I got to travel around with a group from Dubai called Ablaze, and they're still together. And it's awesome just like seeing people all around the world making music.
And are they doing early music?
They're pop music or praise band music kind of stuff. Yeah.
More contemporary.
Contemporary Christian rock, I guess they call it, or whatever. Yeah. And there was also a woman from Mexico, I think, that was in our performing set. It was just really cool to perform for all these people in this like little Polish village, and the whole street square is lit up, and then like walking how many miles, I can't remember, but you take a pilgrimage to a big open field in the middle of nowhere, and the Pope showed up, so that was awesome.
Absolutely. So I imagine that you stay pretty busy between like your studies for your degree and performing in general. Can you walk us through what a typical week would be like? You know, imagine weekends are busier with religious services.
Yeah. One thing I started doing when I left PC was a lot of professional singers will have a quote church job. So I sang in Lutheran churches and Methodist churches, and now I've sang with a Presbyterian church for a while, so that's kind of my Sunday morning gig. And then, so in Cleveland at least, Saturday night, I do the Saturday Mass at Holy Rosary, another Marian church, which is in walking distance to my house and right between my house and school for me, which is kind of nice. And then Sunday morning, I'll sing hymns with the Presbyterians. And then Sunday night, sometimes I'm back at the Holy Rosary singing Mass for their 8 p.m. Last Chance Mass kind of thing, because it's like the church for both campus ministry at Case Western Reserve University, and also there's a lot of local hospitals in the area, so a lot of the people who work funny hours can go to Mass there. And then during the week, so I'm still in class, or actually I guess I'm done with coursework now. I have ensembles, so there's Baroque Orchestra, which I'm singing a piece with them this semester. So everybody's learning on instruments that are a little bit different than modern instruments, but things you would recognize, violins, violas, and then also harpsichord, cellos, basses. And then sometimes there's like a funny looking trumpet, but it's a valve. It doesn't have the valves on top, the little buttons. It's like longer and all of the tubes, yeah, natural trumpet. Anyway, so sometimes I sing with them or play harp with them. And then we have like early music singers, which is really fun. It has members of our community and also students. And so we sing big Palestrina works, or right now we're doing early 17th century music, big double choir kind of things, or lots of different voice parts, kind of, and it's really satisfying to sing. And then I have another little smaller early music ensemble that I sing with, we do more one per part sort of solo things with either organ or harpsichord. And then I also, this semester, I've been teaching some of my friends beginner harp lessons, which is really fun because I loved being a beginner at things, but also kind of guiding beginners through things. That's one of those PC music ed things. And then sometimes I sing a service at the local Episcopal Cathedral for compline or night service or evening prayer. And then there's other sort of colloquium kind of things where all of the music education and historical performance and musicology students and professors will gather on a Friday afternoon and we'll listen to a lecture by a visiting professor. And then in between all of those things, I have to practice.
And it sounds like you're also, you mentioned as like even at World Youth Day, you were dabbling in more contemporary music on the harp. So like, it sounds like for your vocal performance, that's really, you stay more in the early music, but no, a little of both, on both.
Yeah, I mean, lately I've been singing a lot of early music, I also like singing folk music or pop music and then accompanying myself on harp, kind of singer-songwriter stuff that you would see someone with a guitar. but I have my little harps and I can show. This is my littlest one for the listeners.
Excellent. A little more portable probably than the pedal harps that you.
Yes, absolutely. So I can bring it on a plane. I can just bring it wherever, and it, my little harp, not this one, this is a new little harp. I brought it on the plane to Poland, so that was what I played for World Youth Day, and then I had to hike a long way with that harp. Got very strong blisters, but it was worth it.
I'm sure in all of those many different places, you know, given the range of places you've performed and the number of performances you've done in your career, you must have some funny performance stories about things that have gone wrong or things that have gone really, really well, but unexpectedly well.
I guess I just, yeah, maybe thinking about at Cornell University, and I was, we had a maybe a 9:30 p.m. mass, and by that point I'm always just super sleepy, but just having students kind of show up always really pumped to go and like sing in my choir was just so exciting. And I remember one time I sang kind of one of these Christian contemporary pop kind of songs as a post-communion meditation, and the whole chapel is silent, really dark, it's like 10 o'clock at night. And then one kid in the front row of the pew, he was just like, yeah, that was great. I was like, oh, I spoke to that person, you know, like that's the incredible thing with music is like, sometimes, you know, I'm tired, everyone's tired, but I'm singing from the heart and it really touches someone. And I have to be open for that. You know, I have to keep doing my job in order that, you know, other people will experience that or feel some connection.
I just think that is such an amazing anecdote because just like culturally, that is not a thing that people do in Catholic services. Like,
no.
Like Catholic, yeah. Mass, you know, yeah. I think, I feel like I've been in services where people have applauded and like looked around and been like, where am I? Did I wander into some other like denomination by accident? So that is a really extraordinary, that really moved like to even overcome like, this is not what you do at Catholic Mass.
Yeah. And it was also really cool. World Youth Day showed me this, but also PC and other places, just how diverse the Catholics of the world are. And at Cornell and at USC, when I was at USC, it was like the number one international school in the world. Just people coming from all over with the same faith or, you know, going to mass in China or something like that. It's just incredible to see how people come with their different expectations for worship and their different liturgical practices. And, you know, maybe growing up in New Jersey, I had one experience, but I've certainly seen so many more experiences. And I'm always excited to go visit a new church and hear what they have to do.
So, Anna, this year, as you know, the college is also celebrating its 50 years of women, the 50th anniversary of women enrolling as undergraduate students. To celebrate, PC is honoring the achievements of women faculty, students, alumni, and friends of the college. I'm curious if you think your gender affected your experience in PC, and if so, how?
As a music education or being in education, it was a lot of women. There were many women in my music program and also in my civ class. And then having the experience to live with a group of girls and some of the apartments and stuff like that. I have two brothers growing up, so I had, you know, female friends, but I was never exposed to all of the like, oh, getting ready to go out and putting on makeup and getting our hair done or whatever. I hadn't done too many of those girly things before. So I think just having a place to explore what it means to be feminine or what it means to be, you know, have this kind of sisterhood has really stuck with me, and I really appreciate that. And then I never felt, you know, in my civ class, it was maybe pretty split between girls and guys, but I remember feeling like I had a voice and I was always welcome to speak in that environment. And my thoughts were valid. And, you know, I was just always welcome. And that was like a really wonderful experience. And I think, just knowing PC was there to, there's always someone that I could talk to about anything. Or when I had roommate drama my first year, could talk to the music ed professor, Dr. Sitchi. And she was like, let me listen to you, you know, and it was really nice. So I felt very heard in a way that maybe when I was one out of 10 conducting students my second year at USC, I was the one woman out of maybe 10 master's and doctoral students, or maybe master's students, because I was doing a master's. And it was a very different experience. And I it was a little harder to feel like my voice was heard. But I mean, not altogether. They were really conscious of those disparities. And I think, you know, being a conductor and being a musician, there's certain things you might experience. You know, as a conductor, you might experience sexism or, I feel really lucky that I wasn't really on the receiving end of that a whole lot, and that I was part of this kind of generation that's hoping to transform that instead and be more welcoming and open and, you know, using and change, you know, names of things. So instead of when I was directing the Oriana Women's Chorus at USC, now I think it's just the Oriana Choir or something like that. So it's more expansive, I guess.
But it's so interesting. You point out something that we hadn't really touched on, but the conducting community is largely male and just historically, right? This was a position mm-hmm. that you would, the stereotype, you know, when you think about, you picture a conductor, you think of somebody in a tuxedo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so did you have thoughts about that when you were thinking about going to pursue your degree in conducting? Was this something that you considered?
Yeah, I guess it was maybe later when I was thinking about doing a doctorate in conducting that I was looking at some overseas programs and, you know, the older women in my field saying, oh, don't go to England. You know, you're a woman, you won't be taken seriously. And it's not true for everywhere in England, but certain places there's a huge, you know, boy choir tradition and stuff like that. And even today, I, as a singer, sometimes in early music, there's this propensity to ask women to sound like little boys or little girls, because that's the way they did it back then. But I consider myself a woman, you know, and I want to sing with my big girl voice. So, sometimes those situations are challenging because you have to sort of thread the needle of what a conductor is asking of you as a vocalist and what kind of sound you can actually produce. Because being a singer is being very malleable, you know, in choral music especially, it's 1 minute you're singing spirituals and another minute you're singing Rachmaninoff and another minute you're singing do, 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 like kind of abstract new music or something. So you have to kind of be ready for everything, but it gets very tiring when a conductor asks you repeatedly, oh no, no vibrato, you know, don't have any personality in the sound. And so I'm really grateful that at USC, I was asked to sound, you know, have so many different colors of sound in my voice, and that the women around me felt empowered to sing out, you know, in those situations. And, you know, then dial it back in. Oh, okay, we're singing some Stanford choral music from England in 1900, and it has to sound like, ooh. But that's a very different sound than like, ah! Or, you know, something even louder or more explosive. but yeah, it's, I've been sort of keeping on, paying attention to trends in music and what's being asked of musicians and performers, and how those are coded in ways that could be sexist or racist even. Yeah, you know, when you're asking someone who's sung in a gospel style their whole life to, oh, dial it down, you know, or something, and how offensive that must be to feel like your voice can't be heard in a situation. Yeah, it's tricky. Yeah,
right. Because at the one hand, some folks are trying to, they think in their mind that they're aiming for quote unquote historical accuracy, right? But
I mean, but we weren't there. We can't recreate historical ears. So in a way, this faux historical sound that's just stripped of all emotion. I mean, I'm not saying that every group does this, but there's been certain trends throughout time. You know, only boys sing that, so you have to sound like a boy. It's like, well, we don't have any boys here. I don't see any small children running around. You didn't train them to sing like this. I was trained to sing like this, so let me give you what I can do, you know, that kind of thing.
So Anna, you're scheduled to graduate this spring. What's next for you? Obviously, we've got the scholarship and you've got that great travel on the horizon, but what are you hoping to do? What's your next step?
Yeah, I'm really hoping to perform, maybe teach a little. Yeah, sing concerts. I do some Irish folk harping, and I do some medieval folk harping, medieval music. So I'm hoping to bring some of those things on the road. There's a couple of people that I perform with. My boyfriend plays violin, and we have a duo called Time Stand Still, where we do 17th century music and maybe a little earlier. Yeah, I just hope to keep learning. I also play like a giant Baroque harp, which has 100 strings.
Oh my gosh. just to compare, for those who don't know, how many strings do the other harps that you play?
A concert pedal harp has 47. My big folk harp has 36. My small folk harp has 25. And my smallest harp has 13.
Oh gosh. So again, I plead complete ignorance in all things musical. So what is the difference in the range? Like, you play a wider range with 100 strings? Like, that's...
Yeah, so I could go into the mechanisms of pedal harps and stuff. So basically in the 1700s, they decided, okay, too many strings is too many, we've had enough. And so they have different mechanisms to change. So you have one string, and then you can kind of like a fret on a guitar, or a capo holds down one semitone on a guitar. Basically, they figured out a mechanism to shorten the length of each string. So on a modern pedal harp, there's like 200 moving parts. It's filled with bits of metal and rods and all sorts of things up the column of the harp, and then down through the curvy bit, the neck. And so that has these two prongs that shorten the length of the string. So you can do, like, if it's like do do do, so you can do, it's tuned in C flat, and you can do C flat, C major, and then C sharp major, and then every combination in between. Prior to that technology, people were like, we have music that has F sharp or G flat, or, you know, we have to play all these different notes that aren't just the, like, the white keys of a piano. So how do we do that? The answer was just add more strings. So basically the triple harp, which is the harp I play, it's kind of got two rows of white keys. And then in the middle is like the black keys of the piano, but you have to reach through the strings on the outside to get to this middle layer. So you have to kind of reach through and so the more chromatic it is, the more complicated it is. And that's why eventually people are like, all right, enough of this. We can't play complicated pieces that have a lot of key changes with this instrument. And so there was a little bit of time where Mozart was like, the harp has got nothing to offer. I can't use it. I don't like it. But then a little bit after that, then you have like Beethoven, and there's a woman, Madame de la Rue, who is kind of like a Beethovenian composer for the harp. And there's people throughout history and women throughout history who are kind of bringing the harp into a new generation, much like in the turn of the 17th century, there were groups of women that were hired to perform in various courts throughout Italy. And they were harpists and singers and cellists and keyboard players and stuff like that.
So, Anna, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you so much for joining us, but we can't let our listeners leave without hearing a little bit of this fantastic triple harp that you've been telling us all about. So could you tell us a little bit about the selection of music we're about to hear?
This piece is a sort of Marian lullaby, but also a little bit of a mad song, as Mary is holding the infant Jesus in her arms, but also having these flash forwards to the crucifixion. And so it's based on this dun dun, this really mysterious kind of repeating bass pattern that adds to the stability, but also to the sense of insanity that kind of grows throughout this piece.
Dormi, dormi,
Subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, as well as your smart speaker. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.